Right, if I go too far, it's dragged. Okay, so the original philosophy in Samba was that we expose Unix POSIX semantics via the SIFS protocol, which meant that we wouldn't attempt in Samba, for example, to hide the Unix security model. We would work within the Unix security model, not attempt to bypass it. An example of this is that Unix doesn't allow you to set the time on a file unless you own the file or your root, whereas in normal Windows you can, and the initial design of Samba, Samba runs as the authenticated user, which means that you try to set the time on a file that you have write access to but you don't own, it fails. Now, we have options in Samba to tweak this. The default behavior is to not bypass Unix security. We have options in Samba that say something like DOS file time equals yes in the smb.conf. And when you set that, then Samba will use the root privileges that it has to allow you to set times on files that have write access. But the default behavior, at least, was not to bypass any Unix security. And that's a very, very small example. There are examples all over the place in Samba where we had to make compromises as to the precise semantics of the SIFS protocol in order to fit in with the Unix model. A larger example of this is something like the ACLs, access control lists. The initial versions of Samba just ignored ACLs. Later on, we had a mapping between ACLs and user group other style permissions, which is the traditional Unix permissions. And of course, that mapping is extremely poor, trying to map something as complex as a large NT-ACL onto just a few bits of Unix permission doesn't really work. And we got it to do it sort of okay in some cases. Later on, we had a more advanced version of it where we can map onto POSIX ACLs. So if your local file system and your operating system supports POSIX ACLs, then we can do a substantially better mapping between NT-ACLs and POSIX ACLs, and the reverse mapping as well. And that works better than mapping it onto user group other permissions, but it's still not quite right. There are still significant numbers of cases where that mapping is not accurate, and that was okay from our original philosophy, where we were exposing Unix to the SIFS world, but these days, Samba is being used in environments where users expect very precise semantics. So the semantics should match exactly with Windows 2000 or .NET Server or whatever. And we'd like to be able to support that, even if it isn't the default mode of operation. So this talk is about one approach to that. And we've been discussing this for quite a while as to how we might approach this. This is not a new revelation the last month or so. This has been going on for quite a while, although the particular approach that we're likely to take is solidifying a bit and has solidified over the last little while. Please ask questions as I'm going along, by the way. I'd far rather you sort of interrupt and take us down a sidetrack or whatever, rather than having all the questions at the end. So feel free to ask random questions. This is sort of an about Samba. You probably all know what Samba's really is. It started in 91. It was originally a sort of a spare time side project. We've got about 20, 25 team members now. Basically, the definition of a team member is somebody has CVS write access. Of those, only maybe a third of those are active members in that they're regularly committing code, you know, or have committed code in the last few months. But we have a lot of people contributing from the outside who aren't team members as well. It just means they have to go via a team member to get the code in. We've been ported to lots of OSs. It's quite a large user base is built up. There are probably millions of installations, but it's a bit hard to tell. There's over 25 books that have been published about Samba. Some people think of it as like a stealth weapon. So Samba gets into an organization as maybe an early open source or free software program that's used in an organization, and the success of that perhaps encourages people to try other free software. I quite like the life cycle where I've seen companies maybe install Samba on Linux on a small box, and then eventually Linux starts propagating to people's desktops. And I've seen it in at least one company go the full cycle, and eventually Samba is removed. They don't need it anymore because there's no longer Windows on the desktop. And that's really the ideal. We've had a bit of a running joke in the team that the ideal for Samba is that eventually the project would disappear. It's developed using analysis of network traces. If you came to the keynote I gave the other day, that's basically the techniques. It wasn't developed using disassembly. That's a common myth. I've often seen that on Slashdot. It's about 300, 350,000 lines of code, depending on what you count as a line of code. It's used in lots of commercial products, especially NAS products, but also in numerous other things, other devices. There's quite a few devices you can buy at local stores that have Samba in it. Yep. It plays a bit of a different role. NFS is interesting. NFS is an extremely small protocol, very, very lightweight protocol, a dozen or so commands in NFS v2, v3. I think v2 is about a dozen, about maybe 18, 20 in v3, something like that, added a few more. I think NFS is too small. NFS has a bunch of things in it that came from the early days of the way people use Unix systems. And I really don't like some aspects of it where, for example, it's got the fudge factor for synchronization, where the attribute cache time, for example, where you say, okay, I've got this information and I got it within the last 3 seconds, so it's probably still okay. And that's sort of built into the protocol, these sort of assumptions that where coherency is loose to a few seconds. And a lot can happen in 3 seconds these days. I quite like protocols that actually have more guarantees about coherency and playing slightly less loose with users' data. So SIFS is better in that way, but SIFS has a lot of horrible stuff in it. Classic example of that is that the rules for locking of files actually depends upon the file name. If the file ends in .dll, .exe, .com, or .sim, then the rules are quite different, and in fact it's very hard to do proper exclusive locking on files that end in those names. And that was a convenience thing that was put in by Microsoft for very particular reasons, but it was a poor decision long term. And so it's got a lot of historical stuff like that in it. In many ways, NFS v4 is inspired by SIFS. NFS v4 is really a lot closer to SMB SIFS than it is to NFS v3. Much closer. In fact, it's got one problem with v4, NFS v4, it's got a lot of optional stuff. It's a very much a committee type protocol. But if you look at many of the components, the optional components, you can see that they are extremely similar to what SIFS has done for quite a long time, and other protocols have done. So whether SIFS should be used within the Unix community for people who don't have any Windows desktops, I wouldn't have recommended SMBFS. I used to maintain SMBFS at one stage, but so I can say definitely I wouldn't recommend that as being a primary file system, just the complete lack of locking and things in it, and it plays the same sort of NFS games with cache times and things. The new SIFS FS file system that Steve French has developed, which is again an in-kernel mountable file system, that is a much more serious contender for eventually becoming something that you could use in place of NFS. Although there are probably better choices, maybe the likes of Intermezzo and other remote file systems might be a better choice. But I'm guessing that with a bit more development, the SIFS FS from Steve could become a better choice for some target audience of some users than NFS. Okay, so that's the basics of Samba. This talk is going to be concentrating on a particular problem that Samba faces, and this is the problem I call semantic conversion. And what do I mean by semantic conversion? Well, basically, the SIFS protocol defines a certain set of semantics, a certain set of expected behavior. It expects, for example, that you can't delete an open file. It expects that you will have case-insensitive file names. It expects particular locking behavior. All these sort of semantics that the SIFS protocol expects. Now, when you place a SIFS implementation, a server implementation, on top of a Unix-like system, a POSIX system, that POSIX system provides quite different set of semantics. It, for example, does allow you to unlink or delete an open file. It doesn't provide, typically, case-insensitive operation, although there are exceptions to that. And it doesn't provide anything like the locking semantics or the richness of locking available to in the SIFS protocol. So you've got to do some sort of semantic mapping between them. And this happens not just between SIFS and POSIX. The same problem is met with, say, NCP, the Novell file sharing protocol, or with AppleTalk, or with even HTTP. Each of these have slightly different sets of semantics, and it's quite common these days to have an appliance that is trying to serve up all of these protocols at once, and the users of those protocols are expecting as close as possible to a native implementation that has the perfect semantics for that protocol. But you've got then one set of underlying code, the Linux kernel, that's trying to provide all of those semantics to each of these differing protocols. And there's a number of approaches to how you can achieve that semantic mapping, that bidirectional semantic mapping. And in this talk, I'll discuss some of the ways that Samba has provided that semantic mapping in the past, some of the failings of the methods that we've used thus far, and how we're going to be a potential solution for how we're going to solve that. So here's some examples of semantic conversion that are done by Samba at the moment. And this is certainly not an exhaustive list. Throw a dart at a random piece of code in Samba, and you may well hit a bug, but apart from hitting a bug, you'll probably hit some sort of semantic conversion, because a very large part of the code is in one way or another dealing with some sort of semantic conversion problem. So there's certainly a lot more types of conversion going on than what I've got listed here. But this maybe is a good representative list. So you have locking problems, and there's many sorts of locking. There's byte range locking, there's share modes, there's op locks, which might or might not be a lock, depending on your point of view. There's all sorts of different types of locks. ACLs, access control lists. The many people within the Unix world just say, well, why bother? User group other does the job just fine, thank you very much. The point that's being missed there is that the people who are using the Windows clients talking to this server expect ACLs to be there, and they've set up a particular administrative way of administering those servers that assume an underlying ACL system with particular behavior. And when you go and buy a black box appliance, you can't really expect that the people buying that black box appliance as a Windows file server to totally change their administrative habits because it happens to have a Linux kernel inside it. The next thing is case insensitivity. That would seem, you might think that would be a very simple problem. In fact, that's one of the most complex problems. It's very difficult to do that both accurately, race-free, and fast. And I'll describe that in a minute. Short versus long names. You might think that short names have gone the way of the dodo and that we no longer have to really deal with 8.3 names and name mangling. In fact, even with modern clients, Windows 2000, Windows XP clients, 8.3 names do still play a significant role, partly because of the design of the protocol. For example, the wildcard matching algorithm, when you send a wildcard pattern like, star X question mark dot dat, that is matched both against the 8.3 and the long name on the server. So any wildcard processing has to be done in both namespaces. Which means it's going to stay with us for a long time. Secondly, there's a number of applications or libraries or pieces of code that do in fact query and use the short name for files, and you have to make sure that you have the right semantics for keeping those names persistent, etc. And finally, there's simple things like delete rename semantics, when you can and can't rename a file depending on somebody else having it open. Also the semantics as far as share modes. You can something that doesn't exist in the POSIX world is called a share mode, where you open a file with exclusive read, exclusive write, exclusive all, that type of access. And there's really no equivalent concept in the POSIX world. And so you've got to make sure that your delete rename obeys those semantics. Now, there's really two broad approaches to providing these semantics in a user space server. You can either map the required semantics onto the local OS semantics. So in user space, Samba would do some munging in user space, then make a call down to the operating system using standard POSIX-E-like calls to try to map them. Or you can modify the operating system, modify the kernel, to provide parallel semantics, so in which case the mapping is then being really done by the kernel. Samba has used both of these approaches in the past. Current versions of Samba on a 2.4 kernel will use both approaches for various portions, and which is more, I'll go in the next few slides into the details of some of the problems with the two different approaches. Okay, so a good example of this is byte range locking. Now, currently, this is done by a mapping procedure, the mapping technique. So all of the work of mapping from SIFS locking down to the POSIX locking is done in user space by Samba, although there have been some discussions over the last little while, particularly over the last day or two with Willie and Stephen about the possibility of changing that. And so let's look at the differences between POSIX locks and SIFS locks. And in particular, while I'm going through those differences, think about this. When it is in fact much, much easier to give the correct semantics in a user space server if the local operating system doesn't have an equivalent, a facility that is roughly equivalent to what you want. So the local operating system, in this case Linux, does have a byte range locking facility, which means administrators and users expect that when a byte range lock is performed by a Microsoft client, that will appear as some sort of lock in the operating system, so that programs connecting via a different protocol or local programs on the machine will see those locks, because users naively think byte range locking is byte range locking, therefore, really, if I set a lock from this one, it should prevent access by some user running Emacs. Yeah? Samba comes with a command line client called SMB Client, and it comes with a couple of other clients as well, SMB SH and others. There's also two mountable clients, as in kernel file systems, SMBFS, which has been part of the standard kernel for quite a while, since 2.2, I think, and the SIFSFS, which has just gone into the latest alpha releases. Is that what you mean? Oh, I see, modifying the Microsoft client. We generally try to avoid that, because the issues of maintenance is a real headache across all the different versions of Windows. Plus, the main reason Samba has been successful is it doesn't require any modifications of each client. So when you've got thousands of desktops, you don't have to roll out something to each client which might conflict with some virus checker or some whatever, i.e. we look just like an NT server. Otherwise, you might as well have like an NFS client or a, you know, Intermezzo client or whatever, or a coder or something. And the key thing that Samba brings to interoperability and networking is that you don't need to modify the Windows client at all. And a caveat to that is that there have been a number of cases where authentication plugins have been used. Perhaps the best known of them is the NIS plugin, the NIS Gina for Windows. Gina is an authentication plugin module on Windows that allows you to replace the authentication subsystem. And there's a plugin called NIS Gina that allows Windows to authenticate to NIS rather than to a Windows domain controller. That was a very important tool. We didn't maintain it within the team. It was maintained by somebody quite separate. Although the purpose of it has become, it's become less important lately with the advent of the new authentication available in Samba, things like WinBind and the Samba being a domain controller, etc. So there's a number of cases where now that Samba code can replace that functionality without having to actually modify the Windows clients. Yeah, I don't really think so. Remember, we're trying to attract a different crowd of people. When people are running Windows on their desktop, the purpose of Samba is not really to get them off Windows on the desktop. We introduce them to a open source server, and perhaps they then see the benefits of maybe looking at Linux on the desktop. But doing it piecemeal, I think, is a bit of a dangerous strategy, and it's quite difficult. Even writing an installable file system for Windows is a fairly major task and can be quite expensive, even buying the IFS kit. And then there can be various restrictions on distributing things. You'll notice that there are very few, maybe no freely available mountable file system clients for Windows. Are there any? Maybe it is available for those, yeah. But they probably don't have the full semantics. I doubt very much they have the full Windows semantics applications, so there are probably applications that don't work on those file systems, which do because they just don't have the full SIFS semantics. And one of the things that tends to happen is that applications grow to rely upon the very specific semantics of NTFS and SIFS servers. You find that it's just natural when programmers are only testing against a monoculture of servers that you find that the program ends up relying on very particular ordering and semantics. And so if you made significant changes there, you'd find then those applications would no longer work. Anyway, so back to the POSIX locks. As I was saying before, because there is a byte range locking system, we really do have to do some sort of mapping. Whereas in other cases, for example, share modes, which has no equivalent, it's a very easy problem. We just do it all in user space because there is no expectation by administrators that we're going to do share modes because Unix administrators don't even know what a share mode is much of the time. We have some share mode stuff in there now with NFS. Yes, we do take advantage of that, and in fact, there are some share modes hooks, and that was done for a couple of reasons, really for appliances, but most administrators have no strong expectation as to exactly how that's going to operate. So, for example, we don't propagate all the share mode information down to the kernel, but Willy provided us with some hooks to do some share mode stuff, and there is some share mode stuff in the 2.4 kernel. But it doesn't do the full semantics of share modes because that's ridiculously complex. And that's okay because administrators don't have a strong expectation as to how it's going to behave. So doing something fairly reasonable works. Whereas in the case of byte range locking, you have to try and get things much better. Anyway, so POSIX locks are not stackable, SIFS are. So that's one of the biggest differences, i.e. a POSIX lock, a byte is either locked or unlocked. Whereas in SIFS, you can put a lock on top of a lock on top of a lock, then remove one of the locks and the other locks are still there. Both are fairly logical models. Personally, I think the SIFS one is actually a better model for programming, primarily because the POSIX one really assumes that programs are monolithic. And these days, programs tend to have libraries underneath them, and then if the library goes and sets and unsets a lock, say for example, it goes and grabs a lock on this range, then unlocks it again, well then if somebody else had a lock on that range, it suddenly disappeared. I.e., the number of locks and the number of unlocks don't have to match in POSIX, which can be very confusing for some application writers, whereas in SIFS they do match. Second is, in POSIX you can't specify your locking context, which means an application can never conflict with itself with a lock, and that's bad for a server process that might be doing locks on behalf of other people. Because they have no way of specifying, I want to set a lock and set this other lock, and you have to actually detect the conflict yourself in user space rather than relying on the kernel to detect it, because you've got no way of saying that this is that context and this is some other context. It's just implicit in the PIP. And so that's something that I've been discussing with Willy about changing. Signed versus unsigned lock offsets, you would think that's totally trivial. You know, who cares whether it's 31-bit or 32-bit or 63-bit or 64-bit? But a quirk in the SIFS protocol is that SIFS completely lacks any sort of remote semaphore operation. And because of that, people tend to do locks, one byte wide locks at offset 2 to the 64 minus the lock minus the semaphore number to set semaphores. And that means, in fact, you do need to support locks right up at the end for SIFS. So the stacking one, there's an example here, and then advisory versus mandatory locks. If you do a lock from range 1 to 10 and then lock range 5 to 8 and then you unlock 1 to 10, after that sequence, should byte 6 be locked? And in SIFS, the answer is yes. In POSIX, the answer is no. And that is that's the stacking versus non-stacking, and that fundamental difference does lead to some interesting issues. So the next one I wanted to mention is case insensitivity. Applications it's, and I notice I say it's the applications, not the protocol. Applications running on SIFS clients, Windows clients, expect file systems to be case insensitive. In fact, there's a negotiation in the protocol that says whether it should be case sensitive or not, but that negotiation is basically useless because applications often pretty print the name of a file before they send it back to the server. And they might uppercase, lowercase it all, but uppercase the first letter or try and find word boundaries or something, which means you can't really blame the client operating system or blame the protocol. It's really the fault of applications having been written to assume that they're running on a case insensitive file system. So let's look at how we might provide case insensitive access on a case sensitive POSIX file system. And this is the method that Samba uses currently. This is a simplification of the method. There's in fact a whole lot of caching that goes on in Samba to try and make this fast. But this is the fundamental method that it has to use. So the worst case is proving that a file doesn't exist. So let's try and prove that home test data test.dat doesn't exist. Now, that's surprisingly common operation. In fact, a fairly large proportion of all opens on a SIFS protocol tend to be opening a file that doesn't exist, and that's because of the use of temporary files and the way Microsoft Office works. Anyway, what you have to do is you have to open slash and then search for names that match home case insensitively, taking into account Unicode character sets, multi-byte character sets, etc. Open home and search for names that match test, open home test and search for data, open home test data and search for test.dat. Potentially it can cost hundreds or even thousands of system calls, and this is just for one open. So it's very, very expensive. Now we have caching mechanisms, of course, but that's the fundamental problem, that this fundamental method that Samba has to use. The alternative is to add case insensitive support directly into the kernel. And I think that this should eventually happen, but it isn't easy. It's easy to do it badly, but it's hard to do it well. And in fact, I used to teach an operating systems course at ANU, and I gave it as an exercise to students, third year students, to make the Minix file system case insensitive. The smallest patches were about 20 lines, 10 lines or so of patch, very, very small, and made Minix case insensitive. But it did it very inefficiently. And all you need to do in the simplest case is change the file system to use string casecomp, completely ignoring, of course, character set issues, internationalization issues, which really do matter. Change the dcache hash function to be case insensitive. Change the dcache comparison function to use string casecomp, and you're done. So that seems deceptively simple, but then things start to get more complex. We tried to do this in Quantum for the XFS file system. The on disk, we had to change the on disk format because the on disk directory format is a hash, and it's a case sensitive hash. So we had to actually add extra bits into the file system to support case insensitive, case insensitive versions of the directory hash and detect those at runtime and actually upgrade on the fly. We had to start thinking about case sensitive in what character set, building in big character set tables for character equivalence. Per process case insensitivity, we wanted NFS clients to see a case sensitive server, and you get significant problems with the dcache, with d-entries, negative d-entries in particular, become an absolute nightmare. We ended up with a set of 7 rules that described how to deal with positive versus negative d-entries in the dcache, and they were really mind-bending rules. The quote from Alviro was that if this stuff ever went in, he'd no longer work on Linux. So it was really quite nasty. Next area of semantic conversion, other major areas, sort of file ACLs, short long names, delete rename. And with each of these, you have this choice of either doing a semantic mapping in user space or doing some sort of parallel access. Personally, I think that parallel access is preferable, but it requires significant cooperation with the people writing the kernel. And that lowers the portability of the code, makes us more specific to particular kernels, which is a disadvantage. So here's the proposal. The proposal is to do a completely new Samba VFS. Samba has had a VFS for quite a long time. A VFS is a virtual file system layer in user space where we can load alternative POSIX backends and replace the IO functions. This has been used for Samba virus checkers, for Samba talking to Perl modules, to databases, all sorts of things. So in other words, all the file system accesses are done via a pluggable module. Now, that current VFS system only allows a POSIX-like interface, which means it can only represent POSIX-like attributes up into Samba. The proposal is to have a new Samba VFS which hooks in at a much higher level in the code so that we expose all of the gritty details of the SIFS protocol to the back ends. Now, the first step in this is moving the access points higher up. So instead of the VFS having an open hook, it has something like an NT create an X hook. And that will also make things potentially faster in some cases. Moving along a little bit here. The next thing is to create a POSIX backend. That's basically rearranging all of the existing POSIX code so that it becomes a VFS backend, and so that the default backend will be this POSIX backend, so you'll get the existing behavior, but you'll have the possibility of choosing alternative backends, which will try to get the exact NTFS semantics. The next backend I'd like to do, and this is a fairly recent plan, is a SIFS backend. i.e. Samba will have a backend that talks the SMB or SIFS protocol to another server. Now, the reason for doing this is not that it's not because I'm thinking this will be a practical purpose to very many people, but because from a development point of view, it gives us the perfect backend that has the full range of semantics. So it would mean, for example, we can finally support file streams. We have multiple forks in a file in Samba. We'd be able to support the full NT-ACLs and all the other obscure stuff in NTFS. Anything that can come in across the SIFS protocol, we will be able to send out across the SIFS protocol to, for example, a Windows 2000 server. So that will allow us to validate our API, our VFS API, in a very, very accurate manner, write test tools to prove that our API can handle the full range of the SIFS protocol without having to write a backend that in fact supports all of these corner cases. And the next backend we need to write is a reference backend, which will be a local backend, not a remote backend, but all of the metadata associated with files will be stored in a database. The plan is to use like a TDB style database to store all of the ACLs, permissions, ownership. It'll still store file data in a local POSIX file system, but for example, every file will be owned by root.root, every file will be 644 permission, that type of thing. Samba would completely ignore those permissions, and instead the database would store all of those permissions, allowing us to, again, have much more precise NTFS semantics. So once we've got the reference backend and the SIFS backend in place, we should be able to start creating dual server test suites that test much larger sections of the protocol. As I've mentioned in the keynote the other day, these dual server test suites really only work once you have fairly close to the correct semantics. And so this will allow us to get much, much closer, close enough that we should be able to create a dual server tester that covers very large portions of the protocol or any portion we care to cover. And that should, that's the what we call gen test, what I call gen test, which is a generic dual server tester, and should be able to generate the full range of protocol to both servers, look for differences between the two, backtrack, and allow us really fine-tune Samba to have very, very precise semantics. So that will be extremely useful for validating our SIFS protocol behavior. Now, I've already described dual server testing in my keynote, so I'll just skip over that briefly as I'm low on time. Thought I'd mention the NetBench simulator. Some of you may have seen dBench and SMB Torture and tBench, which are commonly used. dBench in particular is often used by the kernel community for IO benchmarking. These originally came out of the Samba team. They are simulators of the NetBench, the NetBench benchmark from Ziff Davis. And I thought I'd show you these results because they're quite interesting. The red line there, the one that goes up a lot and down, this is all on identical hardware. This is a little NAS box that Quantum makes. And the red line is Windows 2000. Then running on the same hardware is various variants of Linux. A standard untuned one is that green line. One of the striking things is the very flat performance curve that Linux has achieved up to extremely high loads. That's the load on the x-axis, the number of clients, and the throughput in megabytes per second. Windows 2000 peaks very nicely at a particular load, but it tends to drop off dramatically at very, very high loads. So I think that's some real kudos to the kernel developers for achieving that. That's number of clients. So that's 0 on the left up to 80 clients. That's number of simulated NetBench clients. And a reason they're simulated is actually setting up massive NetBench labs is an extremely expensive process. And then this is a throughput in megabytes a second on the vertical axis. And there's those other two graphs, the blue, the dark blue and light blue, is from various tuning of the gigabit drivers in Linux and the improvements we've had. The aim of this particular, this graph was part of a project, the tuning project I was in Quantum, where I was aiming to get our peak up to the same level as Windows while keeping it flat going across. And we were making some significant progress. You can see it's gone up, you know, more than halfway there towards the peak. But we didn't quite achieve that. That purple line was when I started twiddling with the LVM PVE sizes, the size of the individual chunks in the volume manager, and I'm afraid I got a rather dramatic slowdown at large numbers of clients there due to that. Anyway, so we're coming towards the end of the time. Other major development tasks that are currently being worked on in Samba is Active Directory integration. We have quite good Active Directory membership code and heading towards Active Directory server. Domain controller development, internationalization. The upcoming versions of Samba will be much, much better for internationalization. New printing and spool assess developments and better management tools. That's really where things are going. And so perhaps we've got a minute or two left if anyone wants to ask additional questions. There's already particular cases where Samba can perform better, and there certainly are cases where we're more accurate, really, at SIFS because of known bugs in Windows. But the aim is really to be compatible. The protocol, it might be a good illustration to say that Microsoft says that when the specification and their implementation differs, it's the implementation that's correct. The specification's wrong. And in fact, the specification is wrong in many places and or incomplete in many places as well. And so we really do need to be compatible because of the monoculture type problem. It's a monoculture of servers out there. And so applications tend to learn to be reliant upon the precise semantics of those servers. So we really have to provide exactly the same behavior. Yep, Willie? Samba TNG, there's really just one person left doing occasional bits of work on it, Elrond, and our relationship with him is quite good. There's basically no features now that are in TNG and not in the Samba, our alpha versions, and they've also, you know, they're not released either. There are quite a number of features in our code base that aren't in TNG. TNG still provides a useful... it's interesting having discussions with Elrond. I don't know where he's going to take it, and it's not really for us to say what he should do with it. Occasionally, Luke used to be part of the TNG project, started the TNG project, Luke Layton, and he still has some problems with the way Samba's developed and occasionally rants on about those. But for the most part, because Elrond is the only person actually really involved in TNG, it's not a problem. Yeah? Right, there has been some discussion. Over having an option in Samba to say behave like NT4 or behave like Windows 2000. This came up because with the recent work that's been, particularly by Jim McDonoghue and others, on Active Directory server support, Windows 2000, when you join a Samba 3.0 domain, actually thinks you're an Active Directory domain controller, and we're not quite yet. And it would be nice that to be able to say, you know, be compatible with NT4 to turn off some of that so that you don't get some confusion going on. So there may in fact be an option to do that at some time in the future if there's a good reason for it. And we're sort of thinking about it. But we won't emulate some of the bugs. Some of the bugs can cause data corruption. And those ones we don't emulate. You know, for example, I discovered one recently where, you know, you do a particular locking operation, it causes an immediate reboot of any version of Windows. And we decided that wouldn't be the best choice to emulate that. Yeah, we decided to give them back an error code instead. Yeah. Yep.
How much of the work on the Unity, like IBM HP, Apple,
There's quite a number of companies, particularly companies, and a couple of those you mentioned in this class, the NAS companies, Network Attached Storage. Samba's used a lot to create NAS boxes. And there's been a number of appliance companies that have put considerable effort into particularly the QA side of Samba, plus things like, for example, Hewlett-Packard currently employs 5 members of the Samba team to work particularly on the printing side of Samba. And so that's had an enormous benefit to the code, enormous benefit to the project. So there are some companies that you might think of could have put in more and haven't, but by and large, it's been very encouraging, the involvement of vendors in the Samba project.
Thank you.